Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series written by Robert Jordan.
Sadly, in September of 2007, as he was working on finishing the series, Robert Jordan lost a long and hard-fought battle.
However, despite the loss of its creator, the wheel turns on.
His widow and editor, Harriet Rigney, has appointed noted author Brandon Sanderson to continue on with the series, and in conjunction with his longtime assistants Alan and Maria and the extensive notes and recordings that Mr. Jordan left, he has produced The Gathering Storm, the most recent book in the series, which consists of 12 main novels and one prequel novel. The two final books will be entitled The Towers of Midnight and A Memory of Light.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com. I'm Virginia, and this episode I'm very pleased to welcome two very special guests, both of DragonMount, Jason Denzel and Jennifer Liang. Hi, guys. Welcome.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me back.
Hello.
It's always a pleasure to have both of you anytime. One of the things that we're going to be talking about, actually the only thing we're going to be talking about this episode, is the new release of The Gathering Storm, and I want to just start off by warning you that this entire episode is basically going to be one big spoiler for that book. So if you haven't already read through the book, you may want to just put this episode on the shelf until you've gone all the way through it. So Jason, I think you kind of want to take over the episode a little bit, right?
I'm always interested in dominating everything never mind.
It's best to just let him do it.
Domination banned in force.
I'm just kidding. No,
he's happier when he thinks he's in charge.
Oh, please. Now you're making me sound like an egotistical warlord or something like that.
I know you.
Okay, well, you can't see me wearing my crown right now.
I'm staying out of this one.
the thing I was going to do is people have probably heard me talk a whole lot about The Gathering of Storm so far, and people in my review has been out there for quite a while, and so I'd imagine that, you know, the last thing anyone wants to do is hear again from me what I thought about the books. So what I thought I'd do is let's go through and talk about some of the high-level parts about the book, just, you know, top level, and see what you guys think about it. Virginia, you especially, you're fresh off of your first read-through, and we'll talk about some of the exciting arcs in the story and some of the events. And then in a future episode, I know that the regular podcast team will be back, and they're all reading right now. They'll all be back, and we'll go over things in a much finer detail.
They'd better be reading right now. That's their homework.
Right now, I know that in magical podcasting land, you may be listening to this at any point, but the day that we are recording this is just 2 days after the book's release. So for most people on the team, they are either still getting their books or still trying to get through it. Virginia is just a little bit crazier than most and has picked it up and has already read the entire thing.
Yeah, it was pretty much one
day. I wonder if she's slept yet.
I did sleep. It was pretty much one long cram session, and I was fortunate enough to have the time to do it these 2 days, which normally wouldn't be the case, so I have to say I'm a little overwhelmed. It was a lot of information in a really short period of time, but oh, I am not sorry I did it. I'm going to just pick it right up and start over again.
All right, well, let's get right to it. So you just finished it. It's still raw. You probably have barely slept. So what did you think?
It was amazing. I think it was a really worthy entry into the series. I loved it. I actually was able to do what Brandon asked and not try to figure out what parts were Robert Jordan's writing and what parts were his writing. I didn't care. I just wanted to just delve into the world again and enjoy it and just be a part of that whole scene again. And it worked very well for me in that state, and I loved it. I have to say my two biggest reactions right off the bat were, almost right from the beginning, I immediately take back everything negative I might ever have said about Fayyel Bashir, or Fayyel T. Bashir Niobara, however you say it, because she absolutely rocked in her short little part. I forgive her everything because of what she did. And the other thing was Egwene. Oh my goodness, Egwene. What a performance.
This was definitely the book that Egwene shines in and proves that she is absolutely the perfect fit for being Amyrlin. And this is where she demonstrated it. This is where all her efforts paid off in large part. And if you are a fan of Egwene, then this is it. Jen, I know you're a huge fan of her. What did you think?
I love the Egwene parts. She's always been my favorite character ever since I started reading these books. I just adore her and everything that she's done. I mean, not everything. She's got some little weird quirks to her personality, but you know, just because she's a real character and not like some fake person. But yeah, I think that she just, you know, the way that she dominates her scenes with Elida, the way that she, you know, just takes control of every situation she's in, not because she wants to be in charge of everything, but because she knows she has to be in charge of everything. She is the right person for the job at the time.
Yeah, you mentioned the scene where she turns the tables on Elida. I believe that there's actually two scenes where they meet. You know, one is in chapter 2, and then one's a little bit later on in the book where she goes and attends Elida. And, you know, at first she doesn't give in to Elida's baiting, and then finally Elida just gets fed up with her and ends up throwing her across the room and using the one power against her. How did you guys react to that?
Well, I think that was really the beginning of the end of Elida with the rest of the sitters. I mean, she was probably skating on very thin ice anyway, but I think that, beyond a question, really proved her lack of fitness for the stole. She totally blew it, completely lost it, and it's amazing to me that they didn't depose her almost immediately after that. They basically just censored her.
Well, I think that's an indication of the kind of chaos that the White Tower's in, that they're like, well, we've got an Amyrlin. Well, I guess we're sort of stuck with her right now. They can't get a consensus together to pull Elida down. They're too busy fighting with each other.
Yeah, and I love the way that as soon as Egwene had any shred of authority or power with all of the Aes Sedai, whether they were her own rebels or the White Tower ones, she basically lambasted them for letting that happen, especially the White Tower sitters. She let them know in no uncertain terms that nobody was going to walk away blameless from this, but the main thing was not to point the fingers, but just to stop. She really is just such a sensible person. It's hard not to take her seriously, and I think that just really shone through in this last part of the book especially.
Without going too deep into it in this episode, because we're going to try to keep this episode short, but one of the things that I would love to hear maybe the rest of the podcast team talk about in more detail later on, but maybe just right now get Virginia your overall thoughts there. How do you think it was possible that Elida was able to use the One Power as a weapon against Egwene? Now, was she really using it as a weapon, or how did she manage to throw her against the wall and strike her? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think it's forbidden. I mean,
I know the answer, so I can't.
Okay, well, it is forbidden, but they're not forbidden by oath to use the One Power against another sister per se. There's a really kind of fine line between punishment and, you know, instruction, and I think that. Wow, that's a tough one. I'm actually not quite sure how she was able to get away with that, but she definitely just lost it.
Jen, you say you know the answer. Can you give us a short overview of what it is?
I remember, I think it was Maria saying something about how the oaths were meant to be updated at some point when Jim was doing one of the revisions of the series, and to include dark friends under the oaths. And Elida was able to convince herself that Egwene was a dark friend, so it was okay to use the One Power against her because she falls in the same category as a Trolloc that way. Also, there's no real stricture against using the power as a tool of punishment if you're not intending to kill the person or seriously injure them. And so you're really not supposed to use the One Power to discipline an initiate of the tower, but that's just custom. It's not law. It's not part of the oath. So you can do it, but it would be frowned upon.
Interesting. Okay, well, that makes sense. And maybe that is the answer then, especially if it's coming from someone like Maria,
yeah.
Robert Jordan's assistant. With regard to Elida, at the end, do you think we're going to see her again, or are we all done with Elida? What do you guys think?
Well, I don't know. I kind of hope that's the end of her. I think that was a really good way to get rid of her and basically write her out of the series if that's what was done. I don't know if Egwene's ever going to be in a position to make any sort of punitive, attacks against the Seanchan or negotiated rescues or, you know, anything like that to get back the sisters that were captured, or even the novices and accepted that might have been captured. But, you know, the only other thing that we had ever hoped was that Elida would spend the rest of her time basically banished to a farm, hoeing weeds up to her elbows in animal excrement. And I think this is an even more fitting punishment for her.
Yeah, I think we're done with Elida. I don't think she's going to appear on screen again. If she does, I think she's going to be so broken by the Sean Chan that she won't be a player. She'll be just a background person. Oh, look, here's Suffa the Domine. Everybody laugh at Suffa. Ha, ha, ha.
Do you think if Egwene had the opportunity to rescue Elida, would she?
I think she would, out of sympathy for what Elida's going through as a Domine. Egwene said she thought it was a fate worse than death, that she wished that Elida had died rather than be captured and made into Domine. So I think Egwene would rescue her if she could.
I agree with him.
I agree.
Yeah, she doesn't seem to be one to hold grudges. She's really good on fitting punishments, but not grudge holding.
You know, for going back to Egwene, obviously, the climax is when the tower gets attacked and she's there to almost single-handedly defend the tower, which was just so cool. But I think my favorite part about that whole aspect of it was that she starts off that battle loaded up on fork root, and yet she still manages to build a circle, find a Sangreal, and power herself up to levels that are, you know, for most Aes Sedai, unheard of. And she does it while she's on fork root at the beginning. I think that was fantastic.
I know. That was truly amazing. I got absolute chills visualizing that scene of her standing in the broken wall of the White Tower, glowing with the power, hurling lightning and fireballs at the rock and until rock. And I was like, and hair blowing in the wind. Oh, my goodness, that was a wonderful scene. I want to do a painting of it.
Yeah, that's one of the things that feels like one of Brandon's contributions to the series, because one of the hallmarks of his work for me is him figuring out what the rules of a world or a system are and seeing how he can play with them within the artificial restrictions he places on himself. So having his heroine, you know, loaded up on fork root and still having to figure out a way to fight off an attacker like this in a very powerful and dramatic way kind of feels like a Brandon thing to me, but really awesomely done.
You know, we may never know exactly what scenes he wrote and which ones Robert Jordan wrote, but I think that this scene is a really good example of the blending of both Robert Jordan's style and Brandon's. I wholeheartedly agree with you, Jen, that I would guess that the, you know, going from fork root to being superpowered Aes Sedai and using the one power in such a legal way, that definitely feels like Brandon, just like you said, you know, figuring out the limitations and trying to see if he can work around them. That's definitely a Brandon thing. But that scene where, you know, where there's a hole in the side of the one tower and she could feel the heat of the flames, they could feel the wind from the beating of the wings of the Turrican, and that imagery and all the imagery that it conjured there, and a lot of the way it was described, it very, very much felt like Robert Jordan there. So I wouldn't be surprised if, based on that, I wouldn't be surprised if maybe that was one of the scenes that maybe Robert Jordan hadn't written per se, but had either dictated or left a lot of notes for, and Brandon just, you know, put it together in his own unique way.
Or it's possible that Jim had written that scene or that particular passage, and Brandon had to figure out a way to get her there from, okay, novice captive, fork root, to crazy badass shooting Torakhan out of the sky. How do we get from that point to that point? And this was his solution.
And I kind of like that solution. Virginia, what do you think?
Well, she was just so level-headed. It was just such an Egwene moment, not only dealing with the situation herself, but sitting there organizing the novices, grabbing everybody she could, getting them together, figuring out how to get around her limitation, how to get around the limitations of all the other people so that the fewest people got killed and the most people were able to be effective warriors. And then, you know, traveling and going in to get to the Sangreal. I mean, she doesn't miss a trick. She's just smart and level-headed. It was such a perfect Egwene moment. I mean, if you hadn't already had her as one of your favorite characters, how could you not love her after that?
I agree with that. Let's we'll have you guys go into Egwene much more deeper and talk about all the different chapters. I think we definitely need to spend some time on the show talking about Egwene and her, you know, the keeper of chronicles that she chooses, and you know, the how and certainly her hunt for the Black Aja. But in the interest of time, let's talk about some of the other high level exciting things briefly, because I know this is another fan favorite that people are absolutely loving. Let's talk about Varen. Virginia, what do you think?
Oh my goodness, that was really hard for me. Varen has always been one of my very favorite characters. I just love her to death. I liked the way that was resolved. I'm really sorry that she died. That hurt. But it certainly cleverly, almost too cleverly, resolved the question of whether or not she was a dark friend, yes and no. But I have to say that that was one of the very few sections where it jarred me a little bit. It didn't really feel as much like Varen as it might have, and I kind of wonder, you know, about how that was written. But it was okay because it was so good. I just went on past it.
You know, it's interesting because I think we're going to see this a lot from everyone as the reactions come in, but I actually thought that was spot on, Varen. And, you know, we'll probably fan base, but I thought that was I wouldn't have been surprised if that was one of the ones that Robert Jordan had left extremely explicit notes for or had even written himself. Jen, what do you think?
I thought the scene was very well done, and I agree with you, Jason, that it does feel like Varen to me there. I don't know, there's just something about Varen, that weird blend of I'm, you know, motherly and vague, but yet when I want to be, I'm very sharp. And I think that was spot on in this section. I do think it was a little on the nose the way they sort of counted down all the fan theories. Oh, you'd never hold the Elthrod. Oh, no, that's a stupid idea. That passage of dialogue. That was a little on the nose. It kind of took me out of the passage a little bit, but it was so cleverly done, I, you know, went right back into it.
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily what she said or what she did. I don't know why it didn't quite feel as Varenish to me, but then that's just me, and there are always going to be disagreements about that. I had to agree with what you said about Catswain, though. I thought her character was completely spot on.
Yeah, a lot of people are saying that they thought Matt was really off in this book, and to be honest with them, I thought Matt was on, but I'm in the minority on that one.
Let's go ahead and talk about Matt. Jen, you bring up a really good point. Of all the, you know, we're only 2 days after the release of the book at the time of this recording, and there's been a lot of fan reactions and a lot of reviews from bloggers and whatnot. And whenever someone seems to be talking about characters that seem a little bit off, Matt's name normally comes up. Now, and this was something that I had, I think I either mentioned it on the last podcast show or cleverly avoided, just, you know, like by a process of elimination, you could probably figure out I'm one of those people that thought Matt was a little bit off. I didn't necessarily think that he was bad, nor did I think he wasn't enjoyable. But for me, it was in that very first chapter where we see him, and he just seemed a little too lighthearted, a little too like the Matt from the earlier books, rather than the more sobered up Matt, or at least the little bit wiser Matt that we see later on. Virginia, what do you think about Matt?
I thought Matt, for the most part, was really fine. The only part that gave me pause was the business about writing the scripts for the guys to play when they went into the town, and actually writing it down and handing out pages and thinking to himself that there was some good drama in those scripts and why were they complaining. That didn't feel Mattish to me at all, because we know he's not a reader per se. He doesn't like to write, and that didn't really ring true to me. But all the rest of it was perfectly fine, and I found him to be very enjoyable. There may have been a little few little things that I'll catch on the next reading, but for the most part, I was pretty happy with Matt.
So he didn't go to the Tower of Genji in this book, and I know that a lot of people, myself included, were hoping that he would, or rather, you know, at least for myself, I'm really, really looking forward to the whole Tower of Genji thing, which I know a lot of fans are. I was a little disappointed that it wasn't in here, but I can completely stand behind the decision that, hey, you know, this book was primarily about Rand and Egwene, and I am assuming that the next book, The Towers of Midnight, will have a lot to do with the Tower of Genji. So, you know, I'm looking forward to, and if there are any improvements that need to be made to Matt to bring him back to how he sounded for the rest of the series, then I'm pretty certain, you could say, wink, wink, that Brandon knows about this and is going to really pay attention to that when he works on the next book.
Yeah, I have to say, I was also disappointed that we didn't do the Towers of Genji scene. I really am looking forward to having, hopefully, Moraine rescued and be back in the series. I think that'd be a big help to Rand, although he did make a breakthrough at the end there.
Well, you said the name. You said Rand. And a lot of to-do has been made about the fact that he's very much in this book. He probably is in 60% of the book or more. I haven't sat down to count it out, but it's probably somewhere around there. This is he's clearly the character who had, even more so than Egwene, I'd argue, has the most stuff happen to him in terms of his character development. Jen and Virginia, the two of you, what did you guys think? What do you think about Rand?
Well, I have to say that I found his parts to be mostly so painful that it's hard for me to really give you an opinion. It was just difficult to see him going through such agony and seeing him doing to himself what he was doing for so much of the book. I don't know. Other than that, I think it's hard for me to process it much more than that.
Rand is a character that, for me, is very difficult to love and to read his scenes, and it has been for a while, since about the Crown of Swords or so, just because he's in so much pain, he's in so much torment, and there's a very natural reaction of, come on, get over it, stop whining so much. There's also a reaction of, how much more of this can one dude take before, he just completely cracks.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it was fitting that when he had that scene where he finds himself reunited with Tam, something that most fans have been looking forward to, I would imagine, for a very long time. It's certainly one of the most talked about scenes before this book that people were looking forward to. And I'm pretty sure that no one would have predicted that, hey, when Tam and Rand reunite, Rand's going to purposely and intentionally almost try to kill him. That's probably not something that we could ever have imagined in that early chapter in The Eye of the World when, he says, goodbye, father, and, will I ever see you again? And so to see him come this far, and actually for himself to see that he had come that far, I think that might have been the tipping point. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think this is when Rand hits rock bottom. We've seen him going down. We've seen him going down pretty dramatically, really ever since Moraine died. And this is the point where he hits rock bottom. I would say rock bottom is when he's in Ebu Dar getting ready to just balefire the city off the face of the planet. And he realizes that, that's kind of a crazy thing to do. I probably shouldn't do this, and runs off. But yeah, I think this was his rock bottom. I think this is as low as he can possibly get.
Strangely enough, I actually had a premonition of that almost the instant that I realized that Cad Swain was sending Nynaeve to go get Tam, because it almost had to be Tam. I don't know anybody else who would have been of such importance that was with Perrin. And my first thought was, oh my God, there's going to be a falling out and there's going to be violence. Because Rand was in such a fragile state. I mean, he thinks he's made himself hard, but he's on the edge, ready to explode. I mean, he may think he's Quendiar, but what a seething volcano underneath that Quendiar lid that he's trying to create for himself. And I was just glad that he didn't actually...
Yeah, Rand is really brittle at this point.
Yeah, I was just glad he didn't kill Tam, because I think that would have broken him 100%.
I agree. And speaking of almost killing and fully breaking Rand, Chapter 22... my favorite chapter in the book, where he is collared and where he is on the verge of choking and killing Min. I seriously thought he was going to kill her, and then the next thing happened. What did you guys think of that chapter?
That was when I had to put the book down for a minute and yell, oh my God, Rand just joined the dark side at Jimmy. Jimmy's my husband. And Jimmy yelled at me to shut up and quit interrupting him from his video games. But then when we were driving back down from Charleston, this week, I read that portion to Jimmy. And then I said, this is when I interrupted you while you were playing Halo a couple weeks ago. And he's like, oh, well, I guess it was justified then.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. Jason, was that the chapter that you had to put the book down and went, oh, my goodness. In your review, you told us that that was the spot, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I had to walk away. And I think when I read it, if I recall correctly, it was late at night And, you know, I was tired, but I just couldn't put it down. But, you know, it adds something when, you know, the room is dark and everything else. And there's, of course, there was no one that I could talk to, you know, and, you know, because, you know, the only other couple of people that I knew had a copy were probably all asleep. And I don't know if they were that far. So I had no one I could share this with. And, but I was just stunned by it. Virginia, what do you think about him taking the true power? I mean, like, how, that's huge to me. What do you think?
Yeah, that really actually shocked me almost more than even what Semirog made him do to Min. That he was able to dig down and find that in himself and be able to channel the true power just like that was shocking to me. It was, I don't know how he managed to do it. I really don't. Excuse me, maybe that is something that will occur to me on my next reread. But I thought that was the point when I thought, oh my God, Rand's joined the dark side. He's become so hard and so almost exactly like what he's trying to defeat that he's able to channel what has only so far been available to the minions of the Dark One.
One of the things that we should probably have you guys explore in a future podcast episode when you do, you kind of go back for the fine-tooth comb, is the relationship between Rand and Moradin. You know, obviously they are not only, Rand is now wearing black and red all the time, which are Moradin's colors. They're sharing physical characteristics. In the prologue to the book, we saw that Moradin was favoring his left hand, just like Rand was. So I wonder, some fans on the various message boards have, who have finished the book, have speculated that Rand is gaining access to the true power via Moradin's link. Not necessarily. It's almost like they both have access to the true power now. Maybe and in return, you know, maybe Moradin has access to, you know, the warder bonds placed upon Rand. Or it could just be something as simple as, and this is kind of what I got the impression for personally, was that it was just simply the Dark One knowing, you know, reaching out to Rand essentially and saying, "Hey, buddy, you're about to kill your girlfriend. I've got a way out. You got to sign here on the dotted line, though. Here's your chance." And Rand saying, "Okay," you know, making a deal with the devil, so to speak. So whether or not there's a relationship with Moradin or not is, you know, something that will probably be debated and the subject of a lot of discussion between now and the next book, or maybe even now in the last book.
This actually substantiates a crazy theory that I had, that the reintegration and the merging that Min saw with another person is not going to be Lutheran, but Moradin. And I was poo-pooed because they said, "You mean the major antagonist and the major protagonist in the series are going to merge together to become one?" And I said, "Well, I'm seeing more and more linkage between them, and everything in this book pointed more and more to that." As you mentioned, Moradin is feeling Rand's pain. Presumably Rand is feeling some things from Moradin. Maybe that's why he's becoming darker and darker, because of the link. That, to me, is the merging that's going to take place. I think they're two sides of the same coin.
I took it as reflection of the Jungian archetype, where your worst enemy is yourself, as a reflection of yourself. This is going to sound silly, but the movie that really portrays this the best for me is Army of Darkness, where Bruce Campbell is fighting an evil version of Bruce Campbell. That's extremely Jungian there.
Oh, absolutely.
Hey, anytime you want to compare the Wheel of Time, to Army of Darkness is okay by me.
I actually haven't seen that, so I'll have to...
Good to know.
All right. So we've only got a few minutes here in this abbreviated podcast. I know that those listening are probably want a whole lot more content, and we promise we will have some podcasts in here. As soon as the rest of the team is done reading the book, they'll come back and go through every chapter if necessary to give you all the talk that you're interested in. But in our last few minutes here, why don't you get Virginia? Are there any other scenes or parts in the book that you wanted to talk about that we haven't already kind of discussed? You mentioned something about Fael.
Yes, I love the scene in the prologue where Fael goes and basically does Massima and gets rid of him for Perrin, because she knows that Perrin is never going to hunt him down and kill him, and he's going to be a constant danger to everybody until he's gone. And I just thought, yes, Fael, you made up for almost everything you've ever done right there on the spot. And she knows it. She knows it. She says it's a dark thing we've done this day, but it needed to be done. So good job, Fael.
Fael is one of those characters that, for me, once in a while will really pull through and prove why she's part of the main cast. The rest of the time, she's, you know, a preening, teenage, passive-aggressive, crazy person. But once in a while, she pulls through and really proves her worth, and this is one of her moments.
Absolutely. Okay, well, I thought of this when we were talking about the scene with Egwene standing in the hole in the black, in the white tower, and the wind blowing in her hair, and to me that was almost the flip side of the coin from Rand standing on Dragonmount, basically facing everything that he's become and dealing with it.
I can definitely see that. Throughout the series, if you kind of look at the Wheel of Time in a mile-high view, from a dragon point of view, from way up top and looking down, you know, on the arcs of the story overall, you'll find that the two most important people in the story, the two most important characters, are Rand and Egwene. I know that the tendency is to kind of think that, you know, Rand, Matt, and Perrin are the three most important people going on. But I'd actually argue that Rand and Egwene are, and that perfectly parallels, of course, you know, the balance of the sexes, the male, female, Sidin, Sidar. And so one of the things I noticed in this book was how Egwene's journey was paralleling Rand's in many ways. And even to the point, one interesting thing, I don't know if it was intentional or not, I'm assuming it was pretty intentional, was that in this book we really see Egwene get beat down, maybe not necessarily physically at all times, but she, you know, just constantly being put down. And I think that it's almost as if it's important for her to have gone through, or at least be able to empathize a little bit with Rand, perhaps if they meet up later, just so that it wasn't just Rand having gone through all this pain leading up to the last battle, that she's had her own struggles that are in many ways equal to his own.
But the thing that strikes me the most about the two of them is that as difficult as both their journeys have been, Egwene has never embraced the dark night of the soul the way Rand has. She may have hit rock bottom in a lot of ways, but she's never embraced the darkness within her. Whereas Rand has basically, as far as I'm concerned, been very much on the edge of beating himself up to the point where he's almost, it's almost like the comparison with Eridol becoming Shadow Logoth. He's so trying to defeat the Dark One, he's becoming more and more like the Dark One in the process of...
Yeah, Dominic over the 13th Depository, we were talking about this a couple weeks ago when we were working on the FAQ, and he called it the Shader Logoth side of evil, that I'll do whatever it takes in the name of the light. Well, that's sort of the opposite of what the light stands for, is doing whatever it takes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a real hope at the end of the book that he's going to be able to do what Catswain was trying to do and what Cerulean was trying to teach him, to embrace laughter, to let that go, and to be more of himself again, because he has the ability within him to do this without becoming, you know, an evil person himself, without harming himself, etc.
All right, and one last topic I'd love to go over with you guys on this episode is, let's do a quick Forsaken roundup. So the Forsaken Tea Party in the prologue, where the remaining Forsaken, most of them, got together and had a little chat, and then we lost two of them throughout the book. What did you guys think of those scenes where that we lost the two Forsaken, both, I might note, by Balefire?
Well, we're assuming that Grendel was, in fact, in the manor house. I don't know if there was a possibility that she could have somehow traveled away during that period of time when the man came out saying that he had seen her and she was theirs. But we have to presume that she's dead. I thought that was probably, as far as evil deeds, probably almost as rock bottom as Rand ever got. But as far as Semirog, well, I don't know if anybody could have avoided killing her like that. I don't even think that was evil. She so deserved it.
Yeah, I don't think Grendel's still alive. I think that was pretty definitive that she's dead, that there's really no way she could have survived that. She didn't know it was coming. You know, she didn't have any reason to believe that there was some kind of sneaky Balefire attack about to happen. I think she's dead. With Semirog, I think that the Dark One was punishing her and, you know, this is how you die because you let yourself get captured by the so-called Aes Sedai.
To respond to that, Jen, I have my somewhat crazy theory on that is I think this is how it played out. I think that, remember in the prologue, Masana, you know, begs to Morda and says, please, we have to go, you know, she doesn't quite say it like this, but she basically says, we got to go rescue Semiraj. And Morda says, no, you may not do it. Actually, I forbid you from doing it. And I kind of suspect, I wonder if Morden and the Dark One are in on this ploy about getting Rand to turn to the dark side. And essentially, they knew that, you know, Semiraj, they basically, if not in the specifics, but they had a general idea that by having Semiraj around Rand and by freeing her, he would somehow present an opportunity for Rand to be in such dire straits that he had no choice but to take the true power. And Semiraj will get what she deserved, being balefired out or whatever, and she was basically being used. And that would be consistent with her final words, which I don't know them verbatim, but I believe Semiraj's final words are, why have you betrayed me? Or something along those lines.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. The whole thing kind of feels like a setup for Semiraj to me, where the Dark One hands her the very tools that she needs to enact her revenge, and it all just goes horribly, horribly crazy pants on her. It feels like that she was set up and that the Dark One was killing two birds with one stone, punishing Semiraj and tempting Rand.
Well, in particular, since Morden forbade them all to go rescue her, and then Shai-Dahiran is the one who releases her, I think that probably Morden can command our super fade, but I think at this point he's basically an extension of the Dark One himself, and that really agrees with what you said. And then presumably Rand was handed the true power. It doesn't actually say that nobody can access it, it's just they're all forbidden to access it. So I'm not sure if that was a give me from the Dark One or just happened. But it looks to me like it was a setup on both sides. He was setting up Rand and Semiraj and trying to see what was going to happen between the two of them, and it worked out. The Dark One was going to win in that respect, no matter how that played out.
Jen, are there any other scenes that you really enjoyed or really had a problem with, or any other things that you want to mention or talk about?
No, I think we hit on most of the points that I want to talk about. Oh, do we want to talk about the survey real quick that we did for Dragon Con and how wildly wrong everyone was when their predictions?
Why don't you go ahead and do that?
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
All right. Right before Dragon Con this year, we put out a survey. We wanted to do a Gathering Storm betting pool, and I couldn't figure out how to make odds, you know, without horribly caminating them. So I did a survey, and we had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people respond to it, and we set the odds based on the percentages from that. And it was really funny because no one predicted that Varen was Black Aja. They predicted that she was of another secret Aja dedicated to the light. They didn't think that she was, you know, secretly evil the whole time.
Yeah, Varen wasn't evil, actually. She basically entered the Black Aja mostly to study them, as far as I could tell. I think she was of the light the whole time. She was just put in a position where it was join them and study them or be killed.
Yeah, and I think that that's a great example of how Robert Jordan put all the evidence for us in plain sight, and everyone tried to figure it out, and he still managed to fool us. And there's been numerous times in the series where he has done that, and in my opinion, that's just a masterful turn. And, you know, I tip my hat to him for deceiving us all with in such a, when you look at it from a mile high, it's like, well, duh, of course she was Black Aja. She's, you know, like the ultimate brown. She dives in to study something as deep as she can. And why didn't we see this before? And apparently only 1% of us, or whatever the statistics from Jen's survey was, showed that, you know, anyone had a clue about that. So well done for Robert Jordan.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say he's got me on any number of occasions that way where I thought I could figure it out. And the master proved me to be unequal to the task of trying to know his mind, even though we study and dissect these books ongoing over the years. And I have to say that, to be fair, although I didn't spend anywhere near the amount of time on the Mistborn series that I have on the Wheel of Time, Brandon totally got me a couple of times in that series as well. So I think he's a worthy apprentice to come along and take over this masterwork.
Okay, well, I think we are out of time for this episode. I'm sorry that's a shorter one by comparison to most of our other episodes. We, and what I mean by we, is more Virginia and the normal podcast team that you guys are familiar with. We'll be back as quickly as they can. I know that all the others are working like crazy to get through the book and taking a lot of notes. And for sure, we would like to hear from all of you. There's a phone number, I believe, for the show that you can call in. That's area code 888-333-7690. Or just email your thoughts to podcast@dragonmount.com. And we want to hear from you. Let us know what you think about the book, about Gathering Storm. Give us a little mini review, and we'd love to hear it. So anything else, ladies?
No, just the other thing is that they can also post comments and crazy theories and thoughts and reflections on the actual podcast page at dragonmount.com and also in the forums. And then also you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and MySpace.
And if you want to talk about Wheel of Time in person with people, you can come to JordanCon.
Yeah, definitely do that.
Yeah, definitely. I'm so hoping I can do that this year. It just killed me to miss them last year, both of them.
You can find more information about JordanCon, which even after its first year was a huge success. And if you are a truly a big Wheel of Time fan and this is your favorite series, or if you just absolutely love the fandom, then this is an event you will not want to miss. And it usually happens in April, I believe, and it's in Atlanta this year. So April, mid-April 2010.
April 23rd, the weekend of the 23rd.
Details at ageoflegends.net. All right, so Virginia, thank you for letting Jen and I show up and dominate your show. Thanks seriously for having us on, and we look forward to hearing what you got, you know, your guests coming up in a couple weeks and having the regulars back on the show. Looking forward to it.
Well, I'm really, really glad that you both were able to join us. You have an open invitation, as you know, anytime. We record once a week, almost without fail. You're welcome to come anytime. We really appreciate you being here, particularly this episode, for this very special occasion of the 2 days after the release of The Gathering Storm. Thank you again. This is Virginia in particular saying we'll see you next episode, and until we are able to meet again, may the light illumine you.
This has been lots of fun. Thank you very much for letting me play with you tonight.
Anytime, as I said. So, everybody, thank you again, and that will wrap up this episode. See you all next time. Thank you.